good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Health and Human Services. This Wednesday, February 23rd, 2005. We've got a public hearing scheduled for immunizations, and we've got a few bills that we'd like to work out today. So we will get started with a public hearing on House Bill 2330 and have Sandy introduce that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House Bill 2330 comes to us at the request of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. It's requiring the Department of Human Services to consider how the department can provide immunizations to persons not currently served. It's also making the recommendation that the department report back to the legislature by May 1st of this year, and it declares an emergency. At this point, there's no revenue, and we have not received a fiscal impact statement of any sort.
All right. Thanks very much, Sandy. We'll ask Gretchen Morley with the Health Policy Commission and Lorraine Duncan to come forward with DHS. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
So I suppose this is a Health Policy Commission bill?
It is.
All right.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. For the record, my name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Health Policy Commission, which, as Sandy said, originally proposed the legislative concept behind 2330. The commission was created, as many of you may know, last legislative session to assist with the policy planning and development for Oregon's health policy. One of the main ways we can do this is by making recommendations to the legislature and the governor's office. In its first year of operation, the commission spent a considerable amount of time tapping experts around the state to focus on improving access to health care, improving quality of health care, improving health status for Oregonians, and reducing costs. The proposal in 2330 comes out of the work group that was looking at improving access to health care. The Commission's recommendations on access focus on not only addressing health insurance coverage as well as reducing other barriers to care, but also looking at the front end to prevent disease before it starts. The purpose of House Bill 2330 is to ask the Department of Human Services to evaluate how state and federally sponsored vaccination programs can be expanded to include low-income adults. Currently, there's the Vaccines for Children program, which provides vaccines free of charge to any provider willing to provide vaccines to children who need those low-income children. The intent is for DHS to investigate whether or not we could create a program that's comparable for adults. And the proposal is based on the ample research out there that the cost of the vaccines up front is far less than the cost of treating the preventable diseases that occur. With that, I'll close. I would like to say that the commission is available to talk with the committee about this bill as well as other commission activities if there's interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lorraine?
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to respond to the request for 2330. The immunization program would be happy to comply with this request. Adult immunizations is part of our major strategic directions and something that we're very interested in. There's no fiscal impact for preparing the report. If we were to actually implement the bill, there would obviously be a large fiscal impact. Because we would be buying additional vaccines. The scope of the bill, the way it's written now, is extremely large. And what we would propose to do is to look at the major adult vaccines with the most cost benefits, which are influenza, pneumococcal vaccine, and hepatitis B. And look at those vaccines. Also look at estimating the number of folks that don't have insurance, and which we have pretty good estimates on, but the number of underinsured folks who have some kind of insurance coverage, but does it cover adult vaccines, is extremely difficult to get at. And so we would need to be doing some inquiry into that to look and see if we can find that. And so we think we'd be able to do this by May 1st without any problem. If we were to look at the full scope of adult vaccines, which includes many other ones, that would probably take longer than May 1st. Just want to give you a little bit of background. There's two funding sources currently for vaccine. They're both federal. One's called the Vaccine for Children, which Gretchen mentioned. And that program basically covers both in the public sector and the private sector. Any child that has no insurance is on Medicaid or Alaska Native or American Indian. And those programs are available, like I said, in every private physician's office that's willing to participate in the program and all public clinics. And I think what the Health Policy Commission is looking at is that possible to recreate such a program, not only for children, which PFC covers 0 to 18, but to do it for folks older than 18. The Vaccine for Children program currently is funded at about $13 million at the federal level. It's an entitlement program, which means every time a vaccine is added to the recommended schedule by the national body that does those recommendations, the pot of money grows. The second source of federal money is called 317. It's also from the Centers for Disease Control. And that pot of money has remained exactly the same for many, many years. So as they add new vaccines, the pot doesn't grow. So it just puts us in a worse fix every time we get a new vaccine, because we can cover it for Vaccine for Children, but we can't cover it if the folks aren't Vaccine for Children eligible. One of the things we've spent a lot of time on in the last couple of years is working on making sure that we use our resources to the best advantage. And for years, health departments served folks who had insurance but didn't always bill. And we're making sure now that all the health departments that serve kids that are fully insured, that we're billing for those. And then that money comes back into the Department of Human Services. And effective February of this year was the first time we were able to offer hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and pneumococcal vaccine for folks, adults coming into local health departments. And so we take every opportunity to look for funding. We know there's not general fund, but we look at for grant funds or federal money to see if there's any opportunity to expand the adult immunization program. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I guess my first question is, why do we need legislation to do to accomplish this? It sounds to me like if it doesn't cost any additional money, that somebody's able and capable of doing it and could probably do it short of passing a law.
I believe that the Health Policy Commission and DHS could work together to provide the same report back to the legislature without legislation.
All right. Questions? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like your scope is pretty large. Childhood, adolescent, adult, disease surveillance. How do you expect to accomplish that in 2 months, or has most of the report already been done?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the Vaccine for Children program, we prepare an annual report that gives us very clear estimates on all the population up to 18. So that information we have compiled. And I think if we focused in on 3 vaccines, we'd probably be okay. The Health Policy Commission was... the way it's worded, it says all folks not served by the Department of Human Services, and we currently don't serve some children under the Vaccine for Children program in 317. For example, we don't cover pneumococcal conjugate vaccine for non-BFC folks. But that wasn't what they were getting at. So basically, from talking to the folks at the Health Commission, it sounds like they're interested primarily in adult vaccines. And if we're truly focusing on the 3 major ones, we could do that by May 1st.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Pretty wide scope.
Sure. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, as has already been testified, the department understands the methods that they can use to provide immunizations through an immunization program. Sounds like they've already identified resources in some cases. And it's already been testified that this can all be done without legislation. I've been sitting here reading this, and you know, this sounds a lot like preparing, having my family prepare a book on how I could be a better husband and father. It probably is worth every bit of money that they'll stick into it, because I know I can be a better husband and father. I just need to have the time to do it. And it sounds like the agency knows what the resources are, knows where the shortcomings are. They can accomplish this without, it's part of their mission statement. And if we want to expand the mission statement, we probably ought to do that in a different bill than one relating to immunizations.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Duffy. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2330.
I've got one in, but it's just for the reading, but I'm really concerned. I have to check it out.
All right. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 58. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 58 allows the Board of Naturopathic Examiners to maintain an injunction against any person who violates licensing requirements that practice in naturopathic medicine in Oregon. It allows the Board to impose a civil penalty up to $5,000 for each violation. This comes to us from the Senate Health Policy Committee, I believe. It moved off the Senate floor with a 26 aye votes and 4 excuse.
All right. We'll ask Ann Walsh with the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners to come forward, please.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ann Walsh, Executive Director for the Board of Naturopathic Examiners. I would just ask your support in clarifying by statute the Board of Naturopathic Examiners' authority to prosecute unlicensed people practicing medicine in the state of Oregon. To my knowledge, almost all professional licensing authorities already have this clearly stated in their statute, and that at this time is what we are requesting. I'd like to make one amendment, and that would be to change the violation part of that statute to be a misdemeanor.
Do you have an amendment already?
I have proposed it. I've put it on paper. I haven't actually sent it to the Legislative Council yet.
Okay.
All right. Where would that change the bill, Mr. Chair, if we can get a line?
If you have a copy of the bill, it would be line 16. Change from a Class A violation to a Class A misdemeanor. My understanding is that a violation is not a crime and a misdemeanor is. And my belief, and I believe the board's belief, is that anybody who is practicing medicine on any of the citizens of Oregon is in violation, committing a crime.
Okay, well, we'll bring this back when we have a chance to take a look at the amendment.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Jason, do you have any other questions on that at this time?
Questions from the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. I'd like to know what other agencies in the state of Oregon have these abilities to sanction to this level, including Class A misdemeanors for violations of their members with $5,000 fines, and perhaps Ms. Walsh could provide that information to our offices so that we can know which of the other agencies provide these levels of fines and the levels of violations versus misdemeanors. And we don't need to take committee time to do that, but I know that there are varying and it just depends upon which kind of license you have as to how badly you can be sanctioned. I don't know that there are people shopping for their future careers and licenses based upon that, but it would certainly be information that I would find helpful to have.
All right. Well, we'll
certainly do that.
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
Can you explain a little bit what the problem is here? What kind of cases have you heard? Are these cases about naturopaths who are doing the wrong thing, or are these cases about people pretending to be naturopaths when they're not?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlee, these are people who have gotten either they're bogus practitioners. They are not are naturopaths that are licensed that are in violation of the law. We have the authority to prosecute. We discipline them accordingly. These are people who get either online degrees or just have decided that by being out in the world they know how to heal. And these are the people who we have a problem getting them to stop doing that.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. is this an issue, though, the licensing board? Or is that criminal fraud, or are there other? If I decide to be a naturopath next week and open up my naturopathic office, is
Representative Greenlit, the problem is that a naturopathic physician has a 4-year in Oregon since 1927. They have to have met the credentialing standards, the licensing standards, which is the 4-year degree, master's degree, or doctorate degree in naturopathic medicine from an accredited school. The problem is the person who gets an online degree and thinks they can practice in Oregon. It's just not clearly stated in our statute that that if you're not licensed, you can't practice in Oregon. And it's just currently what I do is I would send a letter of basically a cease and desist letter saying that they are in violation of Oregon law by practicing without a license. And yet I don't have much more authority than to say that we will send it to financial fraud, consumer protection, if they don't cease and desist. They don't often cease and desist. And it's not, number one, it's not a high priority when you get to the district attorney's office for them to look at when there's actually no harm. And what we're trying to do is to prevent the harm before it happens.
I'm obviously talked to other people. If I decided to practice dental surgery, like my colleague here on the right, and opened up an office and started doing periodontics in competition here with my colleague, would that be a matter for criminal prosecution, or would it be a matter for the dentist board telling me, the board of dentistry saying, hey, you're not a dentist, stop practicing dentistry?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlit, my assumption would be that the Board of Dentistry would be notified that somebody is practicing dentistry in Oregon. They would then, I'm not sure what their process is, but they would notify that person that they were in violation of Oregon law. Depending upon the severity, I would think that they would then go to the district attorney's office and say, we're filing a case against this person, or we're taking action against this person. We believe the district attorney's office needs to as well. No, it would just depend, I think, upon the severity of the violation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlight.
Same question, so pass
that. All right. Any additional questions or comments on the panel? No. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So we will await your amendments and bring this item back when your amendments are ready.
Mr. Chair, perhaps those amendments should address some of the concerns that Ms. Walsh has brought forward. That is defining the practice of naturopathic examiner or naturopathic physician work. Sounds like there's not some clear lines drawn at that particular point. I don't know whether this bill title gives them, relating to the authority of the Board of Naturopathic Examiners, but it sounds like there's some definitional problems there. Just moving it to a misdemeanor and increasing the amounts of fines may just be a money mill. It's kind of a perverse incentive, it looks like to me.
Well, we appreciate your comments, Representative Butler. We'll close the Senate bill. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 58 and open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 and invite Representative Debbie Farforward and Phil Donovan and anyone else who would like to testify. Do we have a sign-up sheet on that? Thank you. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Dalton, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Farr. I'm state representative for District 14. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about women's health. It's American Heart Month, and it is time for all women, especially young women, to take charge of their health and fight heart disease before it is too late. According to the American Heart Association, cardiovascular disease, including heart disease and stroke, is the most dangerous threat to a woman's life. No other killer takes more lives, disables more people, and ruins more careers in our state. This year alone, over 5,000 Oregon mothers, daughters, sisters, and wives will die from CVD. Hundreds more will live with the debilitating effects of heart disease and stroke. And yet the American Heart Association found that less than 20% of women consider cardiovascular disease their greatest health risk. It's time for women to start making our own health a priority and wear red to remind others. What does it mean to wear red for women? Put on a red dress, red hat, red sweater, and tell other women the startling truth about heart disease. You may be aware that heart disease is the number one killer of women, but too many women are still surprised by this fact. Men, too, can show support for women in their lives by wearing a red tie or shirt. Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 designates February 4, 2005 as Wear Red for Women Day. February 4th is just the kickoff of a year-long campaign to raise the awareness of the impact of heart disease and stroke on women's lives. More importantly, wearing red means looking at your own personal risk for CVD, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, lack of exercise, and being overweight. Talk to your doctor about your risk factors and take personal control over them. Make a commitment to heart health the same way you're adamant about fighting off cancer. If you get a mammogram regularly, give the same importance to knowing your cholesterol and blood pressure numbers. Start knowing your numbers while you're young and your risk is low. Mothers can set healthy examples for our families and feel good about the fact that a healthier lifestyle puts everyone on track to living longer lives. The legislature must also make a commitment to the health of women, children, and men in our state. Tobacco, smoke, and obesity are the two most preventable causes of cardiovascular disease. Of course, the number one preventable cause of heart disease is still tobacco use. We must use every opportunity to educate about the harmful effects of smoking. That is why the American Heart Association and the Oregon Health Policy Commission are pursuing policy reforms that will limit the dangers of secondhand smoke and ensure that successful tobacco prevention programs are continued. You can personally do a lot to help reduce the burden of cardiovascular disease for Oregonians. So this February, make it a point to wear red and stay red for life.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the American Heart Association. I just wanted to bring to your attention the Dash 2 amendments. This legislation was pre-session filed, and since that time, some new statistics have become available. And so we wanted to update what had been pre-session filed. We planned on doing it on the Senate side, but in an effort to take the vote on February 4th, we kind of moved the legislation through and figured that we'd get it all tidied up here. So we would appreciate the inclusion of the Dash 2 amendments to this legislation. And just to kind of close on the Go Red, it is a year-long campaign that the American Heart Association is doing in coordination with Legacy Health Systems. We'll be having heart walks and the like taking place around the state, but specifically here in the building. Already some pedometers have been distributed. We'll be helping educate permanent staff in the building on the use of defibrillators that are around the building, and we'll be doing free cholesterol screenings later this spring. So it's our pleasure to bring this legislation. We appreciate your passage of this, and we can get it to the governor's desk.
Chair, question?
Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, is the official name of it Go Red for Women Day, or is it Wear Red for Women Day?
Chair Adolfo, Representative Butler, appreciate the opportunity to clarify on that. Go Red is actually the title to the year-long campaign, but the desire was to make February 4th the declaration of wearing red. And so that's what we basically already accomplished and kind of ran a lot of the pomp and circumstance around it through earlier this month.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Additional comments? Doesn't look like there are any. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr, will you stick around for about 2 minutes?
Yes.
Anywhere you'd like.
You had the schedule for a possible work session. Are we going to work session this today?
Yes.
Okay.
So we will close the public hearing on SCR1. We'll open a work session on SCR1, and I would like to entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments be appended to Senate Concurrent Resolution 1.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the Dash 2 amendments be appended to Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? the amendments are appended.
Mr. Chair.
President Butler.
I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 as amended, which would be Senate Concurrent Resolution A engrossed, I guess, with the dash 2 amendments, be moved to the House, floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? We'll call the roll.
Anderson. I'm both.
Two votes.
Aye, aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Senate Concurrent Resolution 1, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed, and will appoint Representative Debbie Farr to carry the bill on the floor. Thank you. All right. So we will now move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 59 and ask Sandy to introduce that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, members of the committee, this is a Senate bill. This came over to us from the Senate with a 25 aye vote, 1 no vote, 4 excused votes. This allows the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners to set the licensing examination by rule.
Thank you, Sandy. We'll invite Martin Picciani, I think, forward with the Board of Psychologist Examiners, and Damian Merriweather with the Oregon Psychological Association. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Martin Piccioni, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Psychologist Examiners. I wanted to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to testify this morning on Senate Bill 59 on behalf of the Board Chair, Dr. Martin Wechter of Eugene, and the Vice Chair of the Board, Dr. Susan Dale of Portland. Regrettably, neither one of them can be with us this morning, but I want to just convey their thanks and my thanks for hearing this bill so expeditiously. Sitting next to me is Damiana Merriweather of the Oregon Psychological Association, who will convey to you separately the support of the Professional Association for this bill. You have before you some detailed testimony. I'm not going to read it to you. Instead, I prefer to summarize the bill for you in kind of bullet form, and then be happy to take questions on any of the particular aspects of the bill. Very briefly about the board, the basic mission of the Board of Psychologist Examiners is to protect the public from unethical or unlicensed practice of psychology. We have about 1,200 licensees, and we average about 60 complaints per year. The mission of the board is accomplished in part through the examinations in the licensure process. This bill addresses that particular aspect of our operations and really basically does three things. One is the primary thrust of the bill is to remove the specific references that are currently in the statute of the board that require an oral exam specifically. The reason why the board would like to move forward with this piece of legislation is because the national licensure environment in psychology really has started to move very strongly away from oral examinations. They have become increasingly controversial in the profession, and they are perceived as not as reliable and valid predictors of being qualified to practice as some of the alternatives. In some states, there also has been litigation against the exam. The board is open to undertake the work to find alternatives to the oral exam and has already taken steps to improve the current exam based on some of the criticisms. But we have to have statutory authority to actually replace and move away from the oral exam before we really can undertake this type of an effort. This is strongly supported by the board as well as the association and has not attracted any, you know, controversial opposition either on the Senate side or in any public testimony today. The second piece piece that is the second piece that this bill does is that it removes some statutory language that specifies specific content requirements of the exam. There's currently language in our statutes that specifies what type of things an examination has to contain, and this language over time has started to interfere with some of the mobility, professional mobility initiatives that this board has undertaken, and is for that reason taken out by this bill, because we would like to be able to adjust these exams by rules so that we can conform to the basically ever-changing environment of licensure and professional mobility. The third piece is not really what's being done by this legislation, but what is not changed by this piece of legislation. Some of you may be aware that the board statutes relative to examinations have been amended over time to have specific provisions inserted as to the rights of applicants in the examination process. And none of those provisions are touched by this bill. So this is basically simply a piece of assurance for the committee. So issues such as, you know, the rights to appeal, that you only have to retake the examination portion that you have failed, or that you have access to a record of the exam, all of those provisions are untouched by this bill. That's the very brief summary of this bill. I'm happy to take specific questions from the committee as to, you know, the board or the bill before you.
Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me just say that I would commend Mr. Piccioni and the State Board of Psychologists examiners in striving to make their examinations more uniform nationwide, in keeping with the uniform method by which examinations are administered nationwide. I think that's very important. It says something about Oregon's business environment to strive to make a seamless pattern move from one state to another with regard to our reciprocity. And thus it is that my question really deals in part with reciprocal agreements and arrangements, not knowing a great deal about the State Board of Psychologists Examiners. My specific question is, how do we compare to our adjacent states on all sides of us, and then how frequently are the examinations presently being administered? I realize it says at least once every year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, first let me take the question on the frequency of the examinations. We do have historically run two examination runs per year. We have the next one coming up in April, the next one in October, and that's been historically the pattern for at least the last kind of 5 years or so that I'm more familiar with. And we usually run somewhere around 30 to 40 applicants per examination cycle. Let me address the second part of the first part of the question relative to how do we compare on the mobility front to the neighboring states as well as the national environment. I'm pleased to report that we're actually doing very well. The board in 2003, the board was able to get Senate Bill 154 through the legislative session, and Senate Bill 154, some of the provisions you actually see in statute before you, really implemented by law several mobility provisions, not just one relative to reciprocity agreement, but another. Several other options to streamline licensure if you're already licensed out of state. In the psychology profession, the two primary vehicles that are available for psychologists to move easily from state to state are administered by the National Association of the Psychology Boards, and it actually happens to be, in psychologists' case, an association that combines Canada and the U.S., the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards. And they have two primary vehicles, and the primary one really has become what's called the Certificate of Professional Qualifications, which is basically a national-based credentials bank. We have fully implemented that particular provision. We also have fully implemented there's another organization called the National Register that has that has built an alternative credential spend mechanism. We have also fully implemented access to licensure from folks applying under that provision. We have actually also gone a little bit further than some of the neighbors in the states right around us. And actually, Senate Bill 59 is one of those examples. And it has to do with specifically the oral exam. The board has been very, very careful to time its efforts on the oral exam because there are still some mobility mechanisms that require them and others that are starting to drop them due to the increasing kind of controversy around the oral exam. So the board has pursued a dual track strategy of, you know, first we improve what's there, now we're asking you for the authority to look for replacements, but at the same time we're also advocating in that national construct for changes at a national level in the licensure process so that we can time whatever changes we make in the examination to those changes that are happening at the national level.
I have a question regarding the examination while you're there, Mr. Pitioni, if I may.
Sure.
You're also asking for authorization to re-examine certain tested portions of the applicant when they did not pass. Is that standard operating procedure amongst the states?
Yeah.
And you're seeking that authority now. And how will that help in licensure and this high number of 1 out of 20 annually of the number of complaints? Do you anticipate that that will address some of the issues, or will it further allow people that you might have other complaints coming into the profession?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patla, I'm not sure fully follow your question.
Let me rephrase it in two questions. Okay. Number one, is the reexamination of only the failed areas of the tests,
uh-huh,
is that uniform state to state? Or is that, are we seeing that more?
I think that is very uniform, and it's not something that's changed under this bill. That's simply current statute that is not being changed. It's basically an applicant's rights provision that was previously inserted by the legislature that is not being touched by this bill. So it's not a new authority.
Okay, it's added on page 2, line 37, 38, but it may have been
a rewrite of an existing provision. That may be what's the case here.
And the second question I have then, Mr. Chair, is will any of the actions being taken by the board to license or relicense or examine licensure examinations of applicants, will it assist us in this, what I would see as a fairly high number of complaints, 1 out of 20? If the licensed psychologists in the state, you're receiving 20 per or 60 per year, which is on 1,200 licensed psychologists in the state, that'd be 1 out of 20. Is that a higher number of complaints than other states are receiving?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't believe it's an unusually high number of complaints. I don't have the specific, you know, numbers on a national level. You do need to keep in mind, though, that sometimes we are in a situation where multiple complaints are filed on just one occurrence. For example, you may have multiple parties, let's say, in a child custody type situation, which is a situation that is, you know, very prone for complaints because there's very few people that are ever happy on any side of the equation when it comes to a child custody situation. And so that tends to generate a lot of complaints, and you may have a situation where, you know, the mother may file a complaint, the father may file a complaint, and you have to deal with them separately, and you cannot combine the complaints. So that's one of the reasons you may see some of these higher numbers.
Again, Mr. Chair, I would say welcome to Oregon's litigious society. We produce more lawyers than we produce psychologists, unfortunately. But in that regard, I would just, it is a field where it's rife with the opportunity to be sued, I suppose, because it's not, it's a field that unfortunately folks just probably unload on. But I guess in that regard, my angst is that I'd want to know that the board is moving forward to protect itself, and that this is not going to cost additional resources. I did not notice that there was a fiscal requirement in this process that had any fiscal implication. And I would like some assurance from Mr. Piccioni that, in fact, that the board can go forward with its current resources and adopt all of the things that it needs to do so it can license those folks that are in desirous of being licensed by the State Board of Psychologist Examiners.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't actually provide those assurances. There is, in fact, a small fiscal impact on the bill. There is a fiscal impacted document. The board is an entirely other funds agency, and let me assure you that there is, first of all, a policy package in the budget package for 0507 that's in Ways and Means that tracks Senate Bill 59. Basically, it simply is related to the costs of developing a new exam. I do want to state for the record that the board has put in a budget that does not raise fees and does not anticipate raising fees for 4 years, even if this package and the other policy packages get approved. So we do have the resources to deal with this.
Mr. Piccioni, that's sort of a de minimis amount for the construction of a new exam to assuage any potential concerns.
Yes.
And it actually goes down as I look at the statement, and I guess we could probably photocopy this and get this to members of this committee, but it looks like it's $20,000 in the 0507 cycle and $15,000 in 0709, so that's a good trend, I think.
Oral exams can be cheap to administer to 30 to 40 examinees each 6 months, Mr. Chair. I would say they should be able to accomplish this, and again, I'm anxious that we have psychologists from all over the Northwest that just want to do business in this great and beautiful state just come flocking to Oregon. I need them. More and more every hour.
I think that's a good thing. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. My question has been answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Piccioni, thank you for your testimony, and I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this. So the Board of Examiners does examinations at least once a year?
Twice a year currently. I mean, statutory requirement is at least once. The practice has been twice.
Twice a year, okay. And how often is a once a psychologist passes the examination and gets his certification, et cetera, is he ever examined again?
There are the primary thing that every psychologist is subject under post-licensure is the continuing education requirements. Those do recur on a biannual cycle. The only time there would be a re-examination, I believe, it's a very rare case that has not occurred since I've been there, is in cases where somebody goes inactive for I think 5 years or longer and then desires to come back into the profession. I believe that is currently still a rule that's in effect that would then trigger an examination requirement. Don't quote me on that. That's off the top of my head.
Follow up. So if I'm understanding this correctly, then in the past you've had the oral examination.
Yes.
Now you want to be able to have an examination that is probably similar to other ones that are happening across the country. Am I understanding that correctly? And you want to have the freedom. This is not telling us what kind of exam that will be happening in the future, but you want the ability to be able to design an exam that better meets Oregon's needs and also does what Representative Butler is suggesting, mm-hmm. that people coming from other states will be able to follow these exams. Is that correct?
Yes. Chair Delta, Representative Tomei, yes and no. Let me be really, I'm going to try to put this kind of in a very simple nutshell. We're actually not trying to duplicate other exams that examinees already have on their records, partially because we want to eliminate unnecessary duplications of licenses of examinations they already have on their record. We do need to tie in with the national examination requirement to ensure that, A, we don't duplicate duplicate, and B, we only examine on, you know, for example, the Oregon-specific portions. I mean, there has been already a move away from emphasizing the general principles and techniques of psychology portions of the examination, because it tends to be very duplicative of what they already have on their records and what they have been already examined on nationally and in other states. The emphasis now is shifting toward how can we test on Oregon laws and ethics rules, and do so without being duplicative, and do so possibly without doing it in an oral examination context. That's really what's going on here.
Follow up. So if it's not done in an oral way, in what way is it done?
I think the alternative that we would look at is if, for example, we could do it in a written standardized exam.
Follow up. So would that be done in front of the examiners, or is this sort of a write-in response?
It's too early to tell. I mean, the board has not really gone very far down the road of exactly what that would look like until we actually get the authority from the legislature to figure that we can move in that direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you're welcome. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
While we're exercising angst about what's not in the bill, can I check about something that may not be in the bill? Or just to warn you that a question will come later if something is in the bill. I've been hearing from some constituents who are worried about the ability of school psychologists to do their job in working with their students, and that you have something up your sleeve that will affect that. Is there anything in this bill that will affect the ability of school psychologists to do what it is they need to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kleen, there's absolutely nothing in this bill that has anything to do with school psychologists. School psychologists are not licensed by this board. This board has no position on school psychologists.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who does license? You're welcome, Representative Greenlee. Who does license the school psychologists?
The Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 59. Maybe we'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 59. Sorry, you know.
Smile.
Go ahead.
I'm providing moral support for Martin. Chair Dalton, members of the committee, I'll be brief. My name is Damiana Merriweather, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association, which is the professional association of licensed psychologists. We have worked with the Board of Psychologists Examiners in developing the two bills that are here before you today, and we are supportive of Senate Bill 59. There have been past conflicts about the potential subjectivity of the oral exam as it existed, and we are very supportive of the board's movement towards a more objective, more highly regarded method of examining psychologists who seek to practice, and we are supportive. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Yes, I want to go back to the question that Representative Greenlee raised, and that is that DPST is over the school counselors, school psychologists, and not your board. I find that kind of interesting that if an MD were working in a clinic or a nurse, they wouldn't be licensed by DPST. They'd be licensed by the Board of Nursing or the Board of Medicine or Dentistry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first, just one quick correction for the record. It's not DPSST. That's the Department of it's the Department of Public Safety and they're not the licensees for the school psychologists. It's the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission's TSPC. And again, the board has no position on I find the questions interesting, but I can't. You know, I can only speak on behalf of the board, and the board has not looked at this issue.
If I may, Representative Chair, I would be happy to have a conversation with you about the differences in qualifications and training. There are differences between licensed psychologists and those who practice as school psychologists that are relatively significant.
Okay.
And that may not be the conversation to have today in the context of these bills,
right.
But I would be happy to converse with you and any other members of the committee on what those differences are so that you can have a deeper understanding of how that falls down.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, ditto, the board, I'm sure, will be happy to, you know, start having that conversation.
Representative Greenlick, am I on our thought churning?
Yeah, is that to say that you're the one that has something up your sleeve about school psychologists in this session?
Okay. Chair Dalton, Representative Greenlick, I wouldn't say it's up my sleeve, and I wouldn't say it actually is about school psychologists. It's about licensed psychologists who work in collaboration with schools and school districts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative.
I'm trying to flush it out.
That's a masterful sense. Okay. Anybody else want to testify? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 59. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 59.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
I move Senate Bill 59 be passed to the full House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 59 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenlick?
Aye.
Representative May?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Galto?
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 59, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
Because of the appearance of unanimity of discussion and opinion here today, I would make a motion that we move House Bill 59 to the floor of the House on the consent calendar.
Well, Representative Butler, I did want to treat this as an oral examination on the floor of the House and assign it to you to carry, but since it appears that you're going to preempt me on that, I will appreciate your motion and restate that motion that Representative Butler moves that Senate Bill 59 be placed on a consent calendar during discussion. Is there any objection?
I object.
Yeah, you
object. I'd
like to carry it. Well, I'll remove my objection.
Yeah, gentlemen, you'll have plenty of other bills to orally exam Representative Butler.
That's a dentist. Oral examination.
It's a different kind of examination. Okay. All right. Senate Bill 59 is ordered to the consent calendar. We will then open up. Close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 59 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 60 and welcome the same panel forward. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name again for the record is Martin Petioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Psychologist Examiners, and I'm here to begin the oral examination on Senate Bill 60. very, very briefly, I'm not going to restate what the board is into the record. Again, this bill comes before you, you know, without a record of any controversy on the Senate side and with the support of the board and the professional association. Allow me to simply summarize the written testimony that you have before you. Basically, what this bill does is close a loophole in the disciplinary process for the Board of Psychologist Examiners. In essence, there is a possibility. It's a loophole that has been closed by many other licensing boards, and this board would like to go ahead and do the same before we have a problem on our hands. It's related to the fact that we currently have due process requirements that pertain to both the complainant and the licensee in any kind of complaint investigation process, and part of that due process requirement is notifying both the complainant and the licensee at the beginning of the process. Right now, there is a possibility under current law is that after such a notification is issued, that a licensee, if the timing is right, could choose to simply let his or her license lapse and move on to another state and continue practicing. If that happens, the consequence is that the board, A, loses authority to continue that investigation, B, there is no public record generated of any proposed public discipline in that record, because it takes usually several months, and I can go into detail as to why that is and how the process works. It usually takes several months before such a public record can be generated. And basically the board is before you to ask that this loophole be closed and to adjust the statutes to state very clearly that the board has in fact the statutory authority to continue an investigation, and that licensure lapse is not a way to avoid the jurisdiction of the board. It's basically a consumer protection measure so that others cannot go to neighboring states and then apply for licensure there, which will basically not allow the board to disclose any of the circumstances under which the license lapsed. That's the very quick nutshell of this bill. I'm happy to explain it in more detail should there be interest in the committee.
So just to clarify that point, because I thought that was pretty compelling, somebody could, a psychologist could have a potential violation, allow their license to lapse, go to another state, and this board would not be able to communicate to the other state that issue. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you. So getting back to my Ways and Means rules here for just a moment, what's the fiscal impact that you're passing on? I appreciate the fact these are other funds and that we're dealing with the funds paid by licensees. So what is the fiscal impact on your licensees of continuing investigations and disciplinary actions on someone who may no longer be an Oregon resident?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the fiscal impact is minimal. We haven't had a case yet. We'd like to avoid the embarrassment of having a case on our record where we're not able to tell another state that there was in fact an investigation in process that could have led to, you know, we want to keep our due process requirements and not say something until an actual public record is established. But at the same time, in order to be able to do that, we need to be able to continue authority. I don't think that there is a huge fiscal impact. I think the psychologists understand that it is in everybody's interests to fund the investigation, complaint investigation processes of the board to keep the profession healthy.
Follow up. Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Petunia, any indication or evidence that perhaps other states which have not had this particular authority to continue the investigation and or disciplinary action on a disaffected member of the profession, any evidence that other states may have been dumping on Oregon with regard to psychologists coming here which should have been sanctioned in other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no evidence to my knowledge. This is a very the statutory authority we're asking for is a very normal part of the statutory construct across the country. We simply like to be able to catch up with the rest, including many of our own licensing boards in this state, to keep the nets basically closed.
Thank you very much. Additional questions, comments? No? Damian?
Again, for the record, Damiana Merriweather, Oregon Psychological Association. We again come in support of what the board is doing here, as we think this is a really basic tool helping protect the public and consumers, and have absolutely no concern about the impact that this would potentially have in terms of our fees. Investigations already take place, and in the event that you have someone being investigated who would then surrender their license, it would really just be the normal cost that would go with completing an investigation, and we feel that's well worth the cost to protect the public.
Mr. Chair. Representative Butler.
Damiana, any indication within the rules, guidelines that have been accepted right now by the board that those costs should be borne by the person being investigated upon which disciplinary action should be taken, even though they are non-Oregon residents? Is there provision for that in the current board rules?
The board does not have any statutory authority to recoup the costs of an investigation from anyone. There is authority in the board statutes to levy civil penalties up to about $1,000. I think is the max under the current statutes and rules per violation. Now keep in mind, there could be in any given complaint situation, there could be a finding of more than one violation of an ethical principle. So it's not per complaint, but per violation. It's an important distinction. So there is some limited ability if there is an actual finding of a violation, whether it's a licensed practice violation or an ethical practice violation from a licensee, there is some ability to, I don't want to say recuperate costs, because that's not really what it's about, but to basically level a fine. And that does go back to the coffers of the board.
Mr. Chair, I'm prepared to vote yes on this Senate bill today, but I would only do so with the understanding with Mr. Piccioni that he will go back to the board and examine what other states do and what other state licensures provide for in the state of Oregon relative to the fact that costs should be borne by those that are being examined when there has been complaints filed. I, in my own personal licensure and others on this, at the dais here today who have professional licenses, when we have had something filed against us and it is justified, and they proceed, our boards proceed with any kind of actions against us, typically we will end up paying the cost of those investigations and the disciplinary action that's taken by the board, in addition to the loss or sanctioning or censure of our licensure. So I am very anxious about that process, that that not be borne by those, particularly if we've got folks that are fleeing the state of Oregon, that not be borne just because we have failed to put the other kinds of stopgap measures into either our rules, or we do so by statute in the next legislative assembly. So I would just encourage Mr. Piccioni to take that back, and Damian is writing it down very dutifully as well. I think that that's a failure on the part of the board to have taken an opportunity and advantage of mitigating its own costs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Anderson.
Representative Greenlee brings up a good point, and that is that oftentimes fines would cover the costs of the investigation. Is that true with your board?
I think the honest answer is not really.
You don't have the ability to.
No, there is nothing in our current statutes and rules that really is geared toward calculating what the costs of an investigation are and recuperating that. And in most cases, the fines will not cover the full costs. Again, I think that the basic issue, at least in the psychology professions, there has been a recognition that it is that the psychologists welcome paying essentially something into the pot for keeping the profession clean, and they don't have an expectation that this necessarily be borne exclusively by the offending parties.
Okay. Thank you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 60 and open a work session on Senate Bill 60. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 60 to the full House of Representatives and do pass recommendations.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 60 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei? Aye. Representative
Butler?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 60, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move that Senate Bill 60 be moved to the consent calendar of the House of Representatives.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 60 to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objections? We will order Senate Bill 60 a consent calendar, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 60. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 222. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 222, A, engrossed before us again today. We heard the public hearing on this on Monday, the 21st. We heard from Bob Nickel of the Department of Human Services and Bob Repine of the Oregon Housing and Community Services and Jane Loken. This defines the multi-unit residential housing as housing that provides two or more living units. It defines a single-family housing in relationship to housing for people with chronic mental illness. It allows care providers of the residents with mental illness to occupy the community housing, and it allows DHS to sell or otherwise dispose of community housing when it is no longer deemed suitable for housing. I am currently passing out a fax received from Jane Loken that briefly articulates some feelings that she had after the hearing on Monday and for the committee to look at. I have distributed this. I've given this to folks in the audience that have are stakeholders in this topic. They've had a chance to look at it, and they may want to speak to their concerns, or the committee can. They're here to answer questions.
Great. I'd like to invite Marilyn Olson forward, the Department of Human Services. I think that we might have a problem with this proposed amendment, and I would like to move this bill today. I'm not intending to incorporate former Representative Loken's amendment, but I'd like the department to speak to it.
For the record, I'm Madeline Olson, the Assistant Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in the Department of Human Services. We received the amendment early this morning from Senate or committee staff, and I had an opportunity just before this session began to speak with Mr. Nickel, who was on his way to a meeting with the Department of Corrections. We believe we've worked extensively with Ms. Loken and the other stakeholders to craft the bill as it stands today in the engrossed version. We believe, as she put on the record on Monday, that her concerns can be handled through the administrative rule process and would urge the committee to pass the bill as it stands engrossed.
What is the thinking behind, basically, I think in looking at Ms. Loken's amendment suggestion here, she doesn't appear to want to have a one-bedroom, a one-client-type living facility. I think she wants to maximize the number of people living in these units. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that would be my understanding, and we will seek to do that as well. I think what Mr. Nickel spoke to on Monday is the need to have a statute that allows flexibility as time changes, and as we do more and more work in rural areas, sometimes the larger facilities simply aren't functional.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Yeah, Representative Greenlee.
I understood the issue to be that these units may have other disabled people, not only people with mental chronically mentally ill, and that the intention was to reserve the housing units for chronically mentally ill. Did I misunderstand what she was saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, this trust fund is dedicated solely to housing for people who have major mental illnesses, who are deemed in the statute to have a chronic mental illness. So it would not build housing that was for the broadly disabled population. It may build a single unit, I suppose, in an apartment complex. But
if I may follow up.
Yeah, follow up.
Her statement was something like she wanted to ferociously reserve these units for people with mental illness. That led me to think there could possibly be other people in these so-called flex units, and I guess I'm not sure what she's talking in her proposed amendment specifically about something called a flex.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I think she's trying to have a shorthand for multiplex rather than to say duplex or triplex or quadruplex or something like that. She's very concerned that we maximize the outcome of the investment of the trust fund, as are we. And we think the best way to do that is with the amendments that Senate Bill 222A bring forward and sure. proceed with the development.
Okay, I just want to be clear. It sounds like the department feels like they will be able to accomplish this through administrative rule with the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, we do.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My recollection is somewhat similar to Representative Greenleaf, but I thought we had heard testimony from Mr. Nichol that the severity of the case of chronic mental illness should determine the density of the population in these facilities and not try and legislate that in the process. So I'm anxious about this proposed amendment.
Sure, and I think you bring an excellent point forward, Representative Butler. I think the department should have the flexibility to make that determination.
Okay,
we are in work session. Yeah, we are in work session. Yeah, I asked Ms. Olson forward to clarify that concern before we work this bill out. Are there any other topics for conversation discussion? Representative Boone?
Well, I just wanted to add to what Representative Butler said. My recollection is that one of her concerns was that people mainly have a roommate, if possible, but that Mr. Nichol said some people really weren't comfortable in that situation and that some people like to be housed alone in their room or their unit, but maybe as part of another, you know, a multiple unit place, but not having a roommate in their living space.
Or in their bed.
Is that right? In their, yeah, like a two-bedroom, if it was a two-bedroom, you know, some people that would work with, but some needed to be alone in their space, but around other people outside their space.
The other thing I think is that this has to do with units that the department is a partner in developing, right, as opposed to, you know, if somebody living with a chronic mental illness that doesn't necessarily live in one of these department-sponsored housing situations, they can go out and find a roommate situation privately as anybody else might if they choose to live with other people. Does that make sense?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This bill simply deals with the expenditure of the trust account that's available from the sale of the damaged property.
Representative Clement, did you have a comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I spoke out inappropriately.
No.
But I think, as I understand Ms. Loken, her concern was that in a duplex there not be one person with a unit that includes kitchen and bedroom, et cetera, and another person in another unit, that she would like to see more than one person. Say in a duplex it would be maybe two bedrooms with a kitchen and bath. So and then as I understand Mr. Nichol, he said that some people do not want to share a bedroom. They might be able to share a unit but not a bedroom with another person. Am I interpreting that, remembering that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes. I mean, part of what will happen over the many, many years that this fund is in existence, since we will simply be expending the interest earned, is that housing will be developed to meet the needs of the people at the time we're developing it. And there are people for whom sharing a bedroom would be something that would not be doable for them. There are other people, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, who will go into the private marketplace in a recovery mode, seek roommates, and won't be subject to this at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Great. Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, if you're prepared to take a motion, I'm prepared to offer one.
Okay, thank you, Madam, very much. Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, while we're in work session on Senate Bill 2222 as they engrossed, I would make a motion that move Senate Bill 222 to the full House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 222 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Dalton?
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 222, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Yeah, 222A is declared passed. And would somebody like to carry this bill just to talk about some of these issues? Great. We will appoint Representative Tomei to share these issues with the full body. will close the work session on Senate Bill 222A, and we will adjourn the meeting. Thanks, colleagues.